First case on our calendar, 090014, the State of Jillian Marie Graves versus the City of Circleville. Mr. McLandrich.
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I might.
Watch your time there.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm John McLandrich, here this morning on behalf of officers Shaw and Eversoll and Dispatcher Carpenter. This case this morning is about the proper interaction, interrelationship between Section 274403, part of the sovereign immunity statute, and the public duty rule. In this case, the Fourth District Court of Appeals improperly blended the public duty rule with the elements of the sovereign immunity statute. It incorporated language from the willful, wanton, reckless exception to the immunity of the individual officers into the public duty rule, creating for the first time in Ohio a wanton and reckless exception to the public duty rule.
Counsel, it's the Fourth District, and Judge Harsha indicated they're not even sure the public duty rule should have any viability at all at this point, but they said we're not going to go there. We'll leave that to the Supreme Court. And instead worked with it and found that there was enough to get by a summary. This case is markedly different than Sawicki, isn't it? In Sawicki, you could argue there wasn't any duty because Ottawa Hills did not have responsibility across the street in Toledo at the time. But here there is a statutory, express statutory command that you don't release the automobile until there's a court order for someone who has a record like this. So there's an affirmative statutory duty here. There wasn't in Sawicki.
I would agree that the statute in this case does impose an affirmative obligation on the arresting officer or another officer of the department, as the statute reads, to seize the automobile or the license plates under the facts of this case. And admittedly, that didn't happen. I also agree with you that in Sawicki, there was that jurisdictional question that the court could have stopped at in terms of its analysis and saying that Ottawa Hills didn't have any responsibility in Toledo and not go any further. The court obviously did go further to define the scope of the obligations of public officials relative to statutory obligations that are placed on them. And one of the things I want to make sure to point out at the outset before I forget to say it is one of the defendants in this case, Dispatcher Carpenter, is not a sworn police officer.
The statute. We understand that. I want to take you right to the heart of the legal question, and that is Sawicki and the creation or recognition of a public duty doctrine in Ohio was post-Haverlack. Yes, in which this court said there is no sovereign immunity, and pre-statute.
Correct.
And it seems to me it's really a pretty hard case to argue that anything should be left to the public duty doctrine post the enactment of the statute. What's the sense to the statute at all if the public duty doctrine survives the statute, which appears to preempt the field in terms of regulating what exposure exists and what doesn't exist?
Well, to sort of refine my prior agreement with you, Sawicki was decided in the gap between the passage of the immunity statute and its effective date.
And they discuss that in
Sawicki. So certainly the court was aware of it at the time that it breathed life into the public duty rule that this immunity statute was coming into place.
But it didn't. It had no impact on the Sawicki case. It was not available.
Right. The immunity had no impact on the Sawicki decision. But I think, you know, personally, as a practitioner, I think the public duty rule is a vital component of regulating tort liability for public officials.
Well, sure it is. I mean, if that exists, there is no exposure. There's really no purpose to the sovereign immunity statute.
Well, I guess I would disagree from the standpoint of the cases.
What exposure would exist for local government under the sovereign immunity statute, and how do you make sense of it if you overlay the public duty doctrine on top of the statute?
Well, I think that from my perspective, I think the proper overlay is overlaying the immunity statute on top of public duty, because the first question in any tort action is there a duty? What's the scope of the duty? And that's where the public duty doctrine is particularly instructive.
So your answer would be, if it's local government, I guess if it's government of any kind, does the public duty doctrine apply to the state as well?
Well, this court has obviously decided that the public duty doctrine does not apply to the state, and the reason it doesn't apply to the state is because the state has chosen legislatively to waive all its immunity, and beyond waiving its immunity, be treated as a private party, which is obviously a very different posture than the political subdivision.
Well, I thought that's exactly what the legislature did with the Sovereign Immunity Act, to say there will be exposure for these things and there won't be exposure for these things, and it's complicated, and you have to go back and forth to figure out whether you're in or out.
Well,
they define a subset of activities for which there can be exposure, and one of those is if the employees are reckless and wanton in their conduct.
Well, I don't really agree with that, and here's my fuller answer. With respect to the political subdivision in 02, there are the five delineated exceptions that the court has written about and spoken about on a number of occasions. But with respect to 03, it's immunity from suit. It's not an imposition of liability. And unfortunately, what the plaintiffs argued down below, and I think what misled the Court of Appeals and frankly misleads courts every day in my practice, is that people are willing to read the exception to immunity as a cause of action. All it does, if you're willful, wanton, reckless, is remove the immunity you would otherwise have. It doesn't create a cause of action if one doesn't otherwise exist.
Okay, well, let me come back. Let's simplify it. Your theory of how you approach this, what's left? What exposure does local government or employees of local government, what possible exposure do they have for their negligent, or in this case, you have to get to wanton and reckless, for those kinds of acts? What possible exposure is there?
Well, the exposures are several. First off, it's the causes of action that existed in common law when the immunity statute passed.
Give us an example. That's what
false arrest. False arrest, false imprisonment, excessive force, which is generally termed assault and battery at state law. Certainly causes of action where, and the court has found them, where there is a special relationship, where there's a particular class of plaintiff that is to be protected by the cause of action as opposed to the public in general. And then any where the legislature specifically imposes a cause of action or liability on the public employee. Those are the causes that would survive the public duty analysis and then would have overlaid on top of
them
the
immunity
analysis.
Why doesn't the statute discuss that then? Public
well,
duty.
The statute, the immunity statute, doesn't discuss that per se. But obviously, when the court
doesn't discuss it at all, does it?
No, but when the court passed the statute, obviously
otherwise,
it's aware of the common law of the state of Ohio as it existed at the time, and certainly aware of it as it's modified it last time in 03.
Well, but
and the public duty
shouldn't
doctrine,
we look at the statute as having preempted the common law at that point?
I think that the canons of construction would tell us that the common law is only preempted where it is specifically preempted, not by the sort of implication, because the legislature in this case created this sovereign immunity statute, which in many respects was its codification of many of the common law immunities that had been created and existed throughout the years.
Prior to Haverlack.
Yes.
I mean, none of them existed when the legislature enacted that statute. They were all gone due to Havrilak.
All of the immunities, but you know, of course, there were probably a few that were left. For instance, judicial immunity, the immunity for some of the legal officers, and so forth and so on.
Discretionary decisions.
Correct. Correct. So, but in any event, how do we know what the duty of a public official is without reference to who it owes an obligation to? You still need something, whether you want to call it public duty or not.
Another procedural question. The way I read the Court of Appeals opinion, it seems that proximate cause is not before us as an issue. Am I correct about that in terms of the posture of the case at this point?
I would say that's fair.
Okay.
Mr. McLandrish, if I could ask, is it the release of the vehicle without the court order a general duty to the public? And if that ordinarily the officers are protected by immunity unless there is wanton and reckless behavior. Isn't that how we analyze this? And wasn't the reason that the court upheld denial of summary judgment was that there were questions of fact on those issues?
Well, it's a little bit unclear from the standpoint of the court obviously proceeded on to the public duty doctrine. If you found a duty, the court certainly found questions of fact with respect to whether it was reckless behavior. And to go to your first point, the statute, and it's attached to the brief, doesn't indicate any particular class of persons, and certainly the entire population is to be protected by the acts of the officers at issue here. But two things I want to say before I have to sit down for my rebuttal time. One, Officer Carpenter, Dispatcher Carpenter, who's not a police officer, is not covered by that statute. That statute imposes no duty on him. Number two, Officer Eversole, who returned the keys, returning personal property, is also not in violation of the statute. Statute requires seizure of the automobile, seizure of the license plates. The conduct he engaged in is not in violation of that statute. The conduct that Officer or Dispatcher Carpenter engaged in is not in violation of that statute. There's no basis to hold either of them based on the language of that statute.
So you would argue that you're entitled to summary judgment on the first question in that there's no violation of the statute to begin with?
Certainly for those two, at a minimum. Now, what happened, unfortunately, with respect to Officer Shaw was he was the arresting officer, but he wanted to get Mr. Copley back to the station for his BAC test because he's got a limited window within which to do that under the statute to make it timely. He left it to another officer to impound the vehicle, and obviously that's where the communication breakdown occurred. Now, while plaintiffs would like to pretend I'm already into my 3 minutes, I'm just going to say this and sit down unless you have another question. What plaintiffs would like to pretend that this recklessness standard is a very high burden to meet, even in their own summary judgment papers, they acknowledge that the line between negligence and recklessness is a fine line, and certainly for a practitioner, it's an extremely fine line because, as the courts have said and as trial courts always say, is a question of fact for the jury. So to suggest these officers have some great level of protection because of the willful, wanton, reckless standard, I think is just illusory. I'd like to save my last minute and 57
seconds. Mr. McLandrich, you can keep answering questions as long as we ask them, so don't worry about your light.
I'm
going to give you some extra time anyway. So, as you know, the appellee argues that we don't have jurisdiction because this is an interlocutory appeal. You responded in your brief, but I'd like to hear your strongest argument as to why that's an incorrect proposition from them.
Yes. You know, while normally there's no interlocutory appeal for a public duty question, here what's happened is the Court of Appeals has now collapsed public duty and immunity into one step. Because of this willful, wanton, or wanton and reckless exception that they've carved into public duty, if they find a duty because the person's willful or wanton or reckless potentially at trial, then there's no immunity. So in effect, it becomes a denial of immunity. You could never have a duty under their exception to the public duty doctrine and be immune because they're the same standard. And this court has certainly found that interlocutory appeals under 2744.02c, I believe it is, or I'm not remembering the section number right, but are certainly proper. The legislature has created those as final appealable orders. The denial of immunity is certainly a proper interlocutory appeal over which this court has jurisdiction.
Thank you, Mr. McLandrich.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Elliott.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, good morning. If I could pick up where Your Honor just left off, we have made the argument that this is not an appropriate interlocutory appeal. This court 2 years ago in Hubbell versus City of Xenia, I thought, made it very clear when appeals were appropriate under the immunity statute, under 2744.02c, and they are appropriate interlocutory appeals when there's been the denial of a benefit of immunity. In this particular case, and this court has held on three different occasions, that the public duty doctrine and immunity are two completely separate and distinct concepts. The court made that pronouncement in the first case that adopted the public duty doctrine in Ohio, the Sawicki case that Justice Pfeiffer referenced. In 1995 in the Hearst decision, the court said the same thing. And just last year in Rankin, the court again said that the public duty rule comports with principles of negligence, which is irrelevant to the question of immunity. We believe that it's very important for this court to make it clear that non-immunity defenses are not appropriate for interlocutory appeal for precisely what has happened in this case. This case was filed in August of 2003. We have been to the Fourth District two times on appeals, and now we're before this court on three propositions of law that address the scope of the public duty rule, which is a non-immunity defense. And so we would ask this court to deny jurisdiction over this appeal or make it clear, again, that it is immunity.
But how do you separate out the immunity issues? Because the Court of Appeals certainly discussed immunity at great length and basically concluded that immunity didn't apply. And why isn't that then an interlocutory appeal of the immunity issue, because the Court of Appeals went in a different direction and found a public duty?
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. If the appellants had issued a proposition of law that the Court of Appeals was incorrect, that the willful and wanton and reckless standard had not been met under the facts of the case, I believe it would have been a final appealable order. All of the propositions of law, though, address the public duty rule, which this court has said is distinct.
But it was based on the fact that the Court of Appeals found no immunity and went to public duty. So, and the statute clearly says you can appeal a denial of immunity.
I believe, Your Honor, that what the Court of Appeals, the Fourth District, should have done is said, we're going to deal with the issue of immunity, and the public duty doctrine is separate and distinct from that issue, and it's not proper for an interlocutory
appeal.
But they
didn't.
They did not do that.
So that doesn't help you any, because they mixed the two.
That's why I'm asking this court to make it clear that non-immunity defenses are not final appealable orders. And by the way, I think what the Fourth District did is not collapse the public duty rule with 2744 immunity, but instead what the Fourth District did is said that the public duty rule does not apply when there is reckless or wanton misconduct, which has been the law related to the public duty rule since it was enacted hundreds of years ago. And if I could jump to the public duty rule, if the court is going to address that, let me address the scope of this. And there are three very compelling reasons why the public duty rule does not apply in this case. The first is that this is a case, as Justice Pfeiffer pointed out, where there is a specific statutory command to take action, not just to take action generally, but on behalf of specific individuals, police officers. This court has held, again, I would submit repeatedly, that the public duty doctrine does not apply when you have claims like we have in this case that are based on negligence per se. The court issued that holding in the Hearst.
Does immunity statute still apply if you have a negligence per se claim?
I believe the immunity statute would apply to a negligence per se claim. However, once you find that there's negligence per se, in other words, a violation of a specific statutory command, then you go to the immunity statute and determine whether the conduct was reckless or wanton misconduct. And if there was, then you're free to go to trial. If there's not, then you're out on summary judgment.
So you're arguing that releasing the vehicle without the warrant and without following the statute is a specific duty and not a general duty to the public at large?
Yes, Your Honor, there's kind of two questions there. The first is whether this falls in this category of negligence per se. Was there a specific statutory command? And my answer to your question is yes, there was. Those two statutes say that when you pick up a habitual drunk driver, like we have in this case, some 10 MVI convictions, driving on a suspended license from another OMVI 3 months earlier, that these arresting officers have the duty, the command, to not only impound the vehicle until the first court appearance, but to physically remove the license plates from the car.
And who, for whose benefit? The public at large, correct?
I would submit, Your Honor, that this is very much like the Yates versus Mansfield case. The statute at issue in this case was enacted for the benefit of other motorists on the roadway that could have encountered this habitual drunk driver, just like in Yates, where this court held that the statute in that case was enacted for the benefit not only of the sexually abused student, but also for the benefit of sexually abused students that might encounter this tortfeasor down the road. It's exactly what we have here. These statutes were designed to protect the public that were dealing with this driver that night on the roadway, and also any other motorists that encounter him after he's released from jail.
But counsel, aren't we talking about a duty to the general public? It's within the scope of what the officers must do in their jobs. The immunity statute then protects the officers from in the scope of their business unless there is wanton and willful misconduct.
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor. And I would say this, though. When you're dealing with, I think the Justice Stratton's question was right on. When you're dealing with the public duty doctrine, assuming it survives the immunity statute, believe the way it should work is that you make a determination, is this just some general duty that public officials have a duty to follow, or is this a specific statutory command that the legislature felt was important enough that they said, you are going to take this action, otherwise, and if they don't, that constitutes negligence per se. This court made it very clear in the Chambers versus St. Mary's decision that there is a big difference between negligence per se and negligence. This court held in that case that in negligence per se situations, once you establish that the specific statutory command has been violated, you have established the duty and breach elements of the claim and you move on to causation.
Counsel, who's the duty owed to?
The duty in this particular case was owed to the motorists on the road after Mr. Copley was released.
Why just the motorists on the road? He could have run over a pedestrian. He could have gone and done property damage off the road, which to me is all-encompassing of the general public. How do you limit this only to motorists and then say that that establishes some specificity that that negates the whole concept of public duty?
Well, there are two issues there, but I'll address your question. I believe that the statute was designed to protect others on the roadway. Could he have killed somebody, a pedestrian on the sidewalk? Sure, he could have. But just like in Yates, the sexually abusing teacher could have walked out on the playground and abused a kid that wasn't in the school. The statute in that case was designed to protect children that might encounter the defendant in that case. And in this particular case, these statutes were designed to protect anybody that may encounter Mr. Copley, the habitual drunk driver on the roadway. But, Your Honor, I'd also say that...
And how do you get to the specific of the roadway? How is that?
Well, there was no specificity in the statute in Yates that this was designed to protect people down the road. This was a reporting violation.
Well, Yates was only designed to protect children, which is a specific group. I'm still at a loss as how you get to a discrete group being motorists on the road.
I agree, Your Honor, that motorists are not specified in the statute. I'm rationalizing that that's the purpose for the statute. But it's important also to understand that even if you determine that this is a general duty to the public, we need to follow the analysis of whether or not this is negligence per se. Because if it's negligence per se, the public duty rule does not apply. And there's a very good reason for that. The legislature felt that it was critically important in a case like this to make certain that habitual drunk drivers don't repeat their acts and injure people like Jill Graves, a 23-year-old woman that was killed on her way to working at an assisted living center. I would submit to this court that if the public duty rule remains viable, that the analysis is, was it negligence per se? And I would submit that it is. It's a violation of a specific statutory command. And if so, the analysis then goes to whether or not there's reckless or wanton misconduct. And I believe the Court of Appeals has now held twice that the evidence would support such a finding. And that's the key issue.
But we have some fairly recent case law that says absent a addition of the right to sue civilly, that criminal statutes or negligence statutes don't create causes of action. And this is basically a criminal statute you're talking about.
That's true, but this court again has held that where there's a specific statutory command, it creates a duty not to violate that statutory command, which is what happened here. My opponent makes the point in the case that if the public duty rule applies, then you have no duty at all. And Justice Stratton, I would submit that that's a slightly skewed version of Ohio law. Ohio law has held for centuries that there is a general duty to avoid foreseeable harm. This court's decision in Universal Concrete indicated that there is a big difference between negligent conduct and reckless or wanton misbehavior, both in degree and in kind. So I would submit that there is absolutely a cause of action in this case. It was negligence per se, and because the activities were reckless and wanton misconduct, there's no immunity, and the case should go to trial.
If we were to disagree with you on the negligence per se, but also agree with you that it's not a public duty issue, it just falls under the straight immunity statute, where does that place you?
Then that would place us into a determination of whether this is reckless or wanton misconduct.
And you'd still have to prove a violation of some negligence standard to get to reckless and wanton.
You would have to establish some violation of a duty of care, but like the court's decision in Chambers, where the court used the violation of an administrative building code to show some evidence of negligence, I would submit, Your Honor, that we would be able to show the violation of this statute as some evidence of negligence, and then again we would go into the reckless or wanton misconduct
standard. So you would argue even without duty, the public duty doctrine, and without negligence per se, you still have the right to go back, establish a standard of care, a violation that rises to willful and wanton to get you past immunity.
Absolutely, and I think the legislature certainly sent that message when it indicated in 2744.03 that it was not willing to recognize that public officials can escape liability for reckless or wanton misconduct, and that's exactly what we have here. It would make no sense. We have a situation where police officers violated a statute and a young woman died as a result. There is no rationale that I can find that makes sense to allow public officials to sidestep liability and to for families like the Graves family to not have civil recourse in a case like this.
Is the issue of negligence per se before us, or that is still at the trial level to be decided?
That is before you only because I believe that the public duty rule was probably improperly considered by the Fourth District. We raised that issue in the Fourth District, but I don't believe that the public duty rule is properly before this court because I don't believe it's an immunity defense under 2744.
Mr. Elliott, your opposing counsel has separated out the three defendants, the three individuals. Would you speak to that, please?
Well, the two defendants, Eversoll and Shaw, are clearly within the contemplation of the statutes. They were both involved in the arrest, and Officer Eversoll was involved in releasing the car to Mr. Copley in violation of the statute. When he released the car, he actually told the family that he shouldn't go out and drive drunk that night and kill somebody before his first court appearance. Dispatcher Carpenter also is, this is the first time I've ever heard that he wasn't a police officer, but he too was involved in the release of this vehicle to Mr. Copley by filling out the forms that would enable Copley to go to the impound lot and get the vehicle. So I believe that they're all on the hook in this case, Your Honor. There are no further questions. We'd ask the court to send this back to the trial court so that we can have a trial in this case 6.5 years later. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Elliott. Mr. McLandridge, take a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, I looked at Mr. Carpenter's deposition this morning. It's clear they asked him. He's not a sworn officer. He's a dispatcher. The statute by its term only applies to officers. I think it's very shifty ground when you start to take criminal statutes and use them as a basis for establishing civil duties. And further, one of the things I want to impress on the court this morning, I think it's terribly important for the court to recognize that whatever rule they establish has implications far beyond this case. There's a lot of public officials with a lot of affirmative duties to do a lot of things, building inspectors, civil engineers, health inspectors, any variety of public officials with affirmative duties. If every time they fail to satisfy an affirmative duty, it now is transmuted into a civil cause of action, into a tort standard, there's going to be a lot of people liable for a lot of things. You know, maybe in 1936.
Well, counsel, you still have proximate cause. You still have all of the defenses. There has to be negligence on some things, and for other things, it has to be wanton and reckless. So all of those hoops are there to cross. That's what the legislature put in place. I don't know how you make any sense of the sovereign immunity. It's complicated enough, but how you can make any sense of the sovereign immunity statute if you're going to overlay public duty into it.
I mean, personally, I think public duty is imperative to a proper rational understanding of the liability of public officials in the state of Ohio. You know, maybe
to a rational understanding that there is no liability. I mean, that's an outcome rational understanding.
Well, you know, all I can say is that maybe in 1936, when universal concrete was decided, that the courts really understood that there was a dramatic difference between negligence and recklessness. But I can certainly tell you today, in 2009, as a practitioner, that differential is so minute that the cases are going to trial. And part of the reason we have these rules of law, public duty and immunity, is so that public officials don't end up in the courthouse for every wrong. Now, we're not talking about official liability. We're talking about individual liability. And a recklessness standard is a very small jump to punitive damages. And you're talking about punitive damages that are created out of obligations such as criminal statutes. And frankly, I don't think that's appropriate, and I think the court ought to reverse it. Thank you, Your Honor.
If the case is remanded for trial, is the issue of negligence per se, is that still an issue to be decided?
No, you know, the negligence per se is a complete red herring in this case that plaintiffs have fashioned. First off, you have to have a duty to even get to negligence per se, and under the public duty doctrine, there wouldn't be a duty. We would never get to negligence per se, but beyond that.
If there's no public duty doctrine in this case, if there is none, hypothetically, then what?
Well, what the plaintiffs have done is they've taken this standard that out of some state cases against the state of Ohio because of the state's waiver and its agreement to be treated as a private party, and now try to graft it into the public arena. The fact of the matter is that a criminal statute isn't a specific safety regulation that was enacted to provide a level of culpability, a standard of conduct in a civil action. And that, of course, is why there needs to be the public duty doctrine. But assuming your question aside, it's just an apples and oranges kind of thing. Negligence per se just doesn't, frankly, apply in this arena.
Thank you, Ms. McLandridge.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.